And Mr. Curry. Okay. And Mr. Curry, have a seat. Mr. Pouliard, would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal, sir?
Yes, Your Honor. If I may reserve 4 minutes.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Whenever you'd like to begin.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Adam Pouliard on behalf of Sergio Zuniga Robles. This issue is before the Court on appeal on the specific issue of whether or not the trial court erred in failing to instruct the jury that a man is not obligated to retreat when attacked within his own home. The issue is, as raised by the Court and as argued by the Court, as argued in front of the Court, essentially came down to the issue of whether or not there's a distinction in the law between a co-occupant of the home and a trespasser in the home when that person is the aggressor.
Can I ask you at the outset, where was the scintilla of evidence in this case of self-defense?
Your Honor, I think that the Court can find a scintilla of evidence in a couple different ways, and in fact, the trial court in this matter did find a scintilla of evidence in instructing the jury not only with respect to the issue of with-fault self-defense, they instructed with respect to without-fault self-defense, and they instructed on the issue of fault generally with respect to self-defense. I would say that the evidence can be found in a couple of different ways, namely, and this is cited in my reply brief, Mr. Zuniga Robles testified during his direct examination that he picked up several knives to protect himself in fear. There's testimony that is consistent across the parties, and there were essentially three parties in the home who are.
He testified that he picked them up to get them away from his brother.
I believe that there's also testimony, and I know that I cited the exact phrasing in my reply brief, which is that he picked up the knives to get them out of the reach of his brother, and also to, I think that the phrasing isn't exactly protect himself, but it is something to that extent, and I'll certainly flip through and find the exact language. The exact language, and it's cited to Joint Appendix 1471, Sergio described collecting the knives following the physical altercation in which the decedent was the primary aggressor and gathering the knives to stop the decedent from hurting him. That would be, in part, where the scintilla of evidence is. With respect to the intentional act aspect of self-defense, I think that there is a conflict with respect to the testimony of Ms. Schmidt, who comes down the stairs and sees what she believes to be an intentional act of Sergio taking two knives and directing them into the chest of his brother in an overhand stabbing motion. Sergio testifies with respect to standing up after gathering the knives to stop his brother from hurting him, and then his brother running into the knives, essentially. Now, there is cited in the Attorney General's brief the fact that the primary argument of defense counsel was, and really the only argument of defense counsel, was the issue of accident. Certainly, a jury is entitled to make its determination looking at the evidence in the whole. I believe that in the brief of the defense, or of the appellant, we cite to Dela Cruz versus Commonwealth with respect to the issue of the jury is entitled to look at the evidence as a whole. Certainly, the testimony of Mr. Zuniga Robles of Sergio was that there is a wide-ranging struggle, which is consistent with the physical evidence of this case in which blood is found in several rooms. Mr. Zuniga Robles has wounds consistent with the testimony with respect to what a defensive wound is. He has lacerations along.
Any of those were defensive wounds. He claims that it was just an act. The killing was a complete accident.
He does not deny that those were defensive wounds. The testimony was that his brother attacked him a number of times with the knives, which is how there become so many knives spread across the room. And he endures a number of lacerations along the outside, I believe, of his left hand during that. So the testimony is that those are defensive wounds with respect to...
Defensive wounds to him, not defensive wounds of any sort, too. To the decedent?
No, the decedent had, I believe, a total of six injuries on his body, four incised wounds, which are shallower than they are deep, or wider than they are deep, and one stab wound which goes through his chest and is the only wound that is deeper than it is wide.
And it was your client's testimony that those were caused exclusively by accident, by the process of falling onto the knives.
I wouldn't describe it as exclusively by accident. I certainly understand what the court is getting at with respect to that issue, but I would say that the testimony with respect to Sergio testifying that he picks up the knives to stop the defendant from hurting him is sufficient for the scintilla of evidence with respect to that. And I would say that the trial court made this decision quite clearly by issuing the instructions on the issues of self-defense, on with and without fault self-defense. The jury, the trial court finds that there is that scintilla of evidence required for this.
There were self-defense instructions that were given in the case.
There were, Your Honor.
Okay, and in the context of this case, I believe the defendant was convicted of second-degree murder.
He was convicted of second-degree murder and assault with a deadly weapon.
Doesn't that, in and of itself, suggest that the jury had rejected a theory of self-defense in this case?
I would say that the jury was improperly instructed on the issue of self-defense, and perhaps that instruction was what makes the difference in this case, because we're dealing with a situation where the jury has failed to give a full and in-depth version of the law.
Let me ask you about that, if I may.
Yes,
Your
sir.
Contention is that the jury should have received the instruction you proffered that said essentially that there's no obligation to retreat in your own home.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that is not a model jury instruction.
It is not a model jury instruction.
It is a sentence from the, I believe it's the Fortune case.
I believe that that's correct, Your Honor.
And that case contemplates basically the homeowner having an elevated right to be at the place where the violence occurs.
Yes, Your Honor.
In this case, weren't they both residents of the home?
Your Honor, and I think it's an interesting issue, and I think that it's one that was brought up by the Commonwealth during the argument in this case, and it was fairly well addressed, which is the case law in Virginia deals largely with the issue of trespassers and not co-occupants of
in
the
fact,
home.
In fact, there are no cases that deal with that.
And I would agree, and I think the Commonwealth agreed in their brief with respect to the fact that this specific issue is one of first impression in this court. But I think that one of the things that we did in our brief is cite to the statutes for, or cite to the case law from, I believe, both Florida as well as West Virginia with respect to the moving towards this version, towards this view of other states, including West Virginia and Florida. And I believe that the rationale proposed by the West Virginia court, I believe in State v. Hardin, 223 West Virginia 796, is essentially that the reason why we are moving in this direction is to protect victims of domestic violence in terms of the view of this, and that people are essentially entitled to protect themselves in their home, and that that right focuses on the individual who lives in the home and less relates to whether or not the other party has entered into the home. And certainly while the issue of trespasser versus co-occupant became a large portion of the issue for the trial judge, I would say that there is no case law that actually distinguishes it. While it is the case in all of the prior cases that we're dealing with that it is a trespasser upon the home, the issue is never raised, and there is no distinguishing. There's no case law that says the trespasser is the only one who inviolates or who enables a person not to have this sort of description of the law.
Do you believe that one or both of the individuals involved in the altercation were entitled to the prescriptions of the capital doctrine?
Your Honor, I would say that both of them are entitled to it.
If I butcher the phraseology of this question, please tell me that you need it rephrased, because I can butcher a question like no other. If we disagree with you, or if we were to disagree with you and conclude that there is not a scintilla of evidence on the issue of self-defense, then obviously the jury shouldn't have been instructed on self-defense to begin with.
Yes, sir.
Under those circumstances, how would you survive harmless error scrutiny?
And if I may just restate the question to ensure that I understood it properly. The court is asking whether or not we would survive the harmless error analysis if the court determines that there is not a scintilla of evidence.
On the issue of self-defense.
Your Honor, I don't believe that we do survive the harmless error doctrine if the court were to find that there isn't a scintilla of evidence here. I would say that there is no argument there if the court determines that there is not a scintilla of evidence. But I think it's important to understand that the trial court who was sitting and hearing all of this evidence and reviewing all of this evidence did make the determination that there was a scintilla of evidence and quite clearly makes that determination, I believe makes that determination on the record, as it issues the jury instructions with respect to self-defense, I believe that Judge Irby specifically states, I am finding that there is a scintilla of evidence, and I couldn't tell the court specifically where that is in the joint appendix, and I apologize for that, but I believe it's a pretty clear ruling on the part of the trial judge, and to say now that we're going to step in on insert our own judgment on behalf of the trial court and say there's not a scintilla of evidence is to discard what was a reasonable and founded ruling. Now, I don't necessarily agree with the court's ruling with respect to the issue of whether or not rejecting this instruction was appropriate on the issue of whether or not a person is obligated to retreat if assaulted in their home.
And I'm glad you said it that way, because one thing sort of feeds into the other. Even if the trial judge said there is a scintilla of evidence to support, in your mind, the giving of the instruction that you suggested, wouldn't we still be able to get to a harmless error analysis if there were other evidence in the record to support the conviction?
I believe that we can get to a harmless error analysis. If the court were to say there is not a scintilla of evidence with respect to the issue of self-defense as a whole, then I think that we don't reach the harmless error analysis. If the court is to say that there's not a scintilla of evidence with respect to the issue of I don't see a distinction that allows the court to say there's not a scintilla of evidence with respect to whether or not a person is required to retreat in the home if the court says there's a scintilla of evidence with respect to the issue of self-defense.
You're into your rebuttal if you want to.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Sure, thank you. Mr. Curry.
May it please the court, William Curry on behalf of the Commonwealth in this matter. The Commonwealth's position is that the trial court's refusal to instruct the jury that I've been saying Robles, but I apologize if it's Robles or Robles. That the refusal to instruct the jury that he had no duty to retreat is, if it was erroneous, was harmless because there was no evidence in this record to support the issuance of the self-defense instructions. The appellant's testimony was the only evidence that was offered at trial that could support a jury instruction for either justified or excusable self-defense. But as it's Commonwealth's position that his testimony fails to provide even a scintilla of evidence and support. He maintains throughout his testimony that the entire act of killing was accidental. It was unintentional. He denied having stabbed his brother. He testified in a very...
But there could be, under our rules, there can be alternative theories propounded by a defendant in defense of his case. You can say it was an accident. If it wasn't an accident, it was self-defense. If it wasn't self-defense, it was justified. You could come up with all kinds of theories in the context of the presentation of your evidence, can't you?
Yes, Your Honor. But those theories, in order to warrant a jury instruction, still have to be supported by some scintilla of evidence. And the Commonwealth's position is there is none here. It wasn't even until cross-examination that there even became the slightest clue of how the victim even died. Previously on direct, the appellant had testified that he was unaware that his brother was stabbed, even though at the time he was laying on the ground with a fatal stab wound to his upper chest. He believed that he was having an epileptic attack. I lost my train of thought. So there's no scintilla of evidence that he was acting in self-defense, that out of necessity he took an act to save his own life in the face of a unreasonable fear of his own safety. In order for the appellant to have been entitled to a jury instruction on self-defense, he would have had to, you would have to reject his own testimony that it was an accident. However, it's as the Commonwealth cited in its brief, the jury can reject the evidence of the defendant as a basis for an acquittal, but the rejection of that evidence does not serve as the proper basis for evidence to support a jury instruction. And because
let me ask you this: it seems that the trial judge was of the view that the defendant in the action below was entitled to a general self-defense instruction. with the facts and circumstances presented in the case and that they are at least co-owners or co-occupants of the property, what element is missing which would entitle the defendant to receive the more specific instruction regarding his status regarding the matter?
Well, the curious thing about when the, I guess, the justifiable versus excusable self-defense instructions were litigated, which ones were appropriate, the trial court granted the instruction, granted both instructions, but specifically granted the one for justifiable self-defense at the appellant's request. When
and I assume, as you go on to answer Judge Alston's question, your position is those should have been granted to begin with.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is the Commonwealth's position. Under a theory of justifiable self-defense, which we can look at the instruction that was given in this case, it appears to be instruction N, which is on appendix page 204, that there is no duty to retreat under that circumstance because that is just the law of self-defense in Virginia. When
it's the Castle Doctrine.
Well, I think it would apply in any situation because if you are without fault, you never would have a duty to retreat. And if we look at the instruction that is essentially being challenged, which is instruction L, essentially what the argument of the appellant is that he wanted to have this instruction, or he wished that this instruction had been given, this is his argument on appeal at least, without the requirement of, I guess, subsections 1 and 2, that he would not have to have retreated as safely as he could under the circumstances, and that he would not have to make known his desire for peace. The interesting issue that is raised with that argument on appeal is in the trial court, the appellant argued that he was not entitled to an instruction for excusable self-defense. That argument occurred in the appendix around page 1640. Robles told the court that there was less than a scintilla of evidence in support of a with fault or excusable self-defense instruction. So he abandoned that argument. And specifically, I have some of the passages here. He says the only evidence really adduced on who was the aggressor causing the fight was Mario. So I don't think that there's anything here that would suggest a with fault instruction that Sergio was at fault. The only evidence about an aggressor is that Mario was the aggressor. And he goes on, the only thing that there's a scintilla of evidence for, the only thing there's is a without fault self-defense. So again, while both can coexist, both could go in, I think that with fault is inappropriate. So effectively, what the argument is on appeal is that the appellant wants it's kind of a waiver, approbate and reprobate type argument. He has asserted to the trial court that there's no evidence in support of the legal conclusion that a jury could reach that he was with fault.
Because he was maintaining that he was retreating the entire time.
Yes. And
but
so
isn't that more a strategy decision? Because if you're essentially saying that there is an instruction which justifies justifiable self-defense, then doesn't that in a way undermine the argument that you're retreating and so for a strategic reason, I don't want to have that instruction because it might confuse a fact finder?
Well, I think the way you would handle that would say I oppose this instruction going before the jury. But if the legal reasoning is that there's no scintilla of evidence to support it, and you require that scintilla of evidence to create...
So that's more traditional approbate and reprobate, because there you're not making a strategic decision. You're basically saying that instruction is not applicable.
Right, okay. Because there is no duty to retreat.
In other words, my position is that he died by accident. He fell into the knives. But if for some reason the jury doesn't buy what I'm selling, then maybe they'll at least think that I did it in self-defense. So trying to have the best of both worlds.
I think so. And I think that if this matter is reversed on that basis, then he will have achieved a windfall. He'll have another chance to present the evidence. And I think that the fact that this there's additional evidence in this record that there was no scintilla of evidence in support of either self-defense instruction. We have, I guess one way to look at it is the parties got to put forward the evidence they wanted, and they got to make the arguments they wanted that were supported by that evidence to the jury. The Commonwealth put forward its evidence that this was a murder in the first degree, that where the appellant stabbed his brother with premeditation and deliberation. The jury ultimately found murder in the second degree, but that was the theory of the Commonwealth's case. The theory of the appellant's case was that this was an accident, and the defendant having asserted to the trial court that he, or counsel having asserted to the trial court that there was no evidence in support of the self-defense without fault, or with fault, excuse me, didn't provide any arguments to the jury on that basis, because even though an instruction had been given. And the defendant also didn't present any evidence that he was acting in self-defense with fault. Instead, he proceeded entirely on his accident theory. The counsel specifically directed the jury to review the instruction on accident and urged them to conclude that the Commonwealth had not met its burden of proving that the victim's death was not an accident here. Counsel summarized the defense's theory of the case by saying it's a tragic accident occurred. I truly tell you it is. This is a tragedy in any sense. The defendant put forward his arguments that were supported by his evidence and his theory of the case. There's no evidence in support of either self-defense instruction in this matter. And so the fact that the defendant was not alleges that he was not adequately that the jury was not adequately instructed on self-defense is harmless error, because they were not entitled to any instruction on that theory at all. If the court has any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I cede my time to the court.
Thank you, Mr. Curry.
Thank you.
We got time.
Mr. Pulliar.
With respect to the issue of whether or not there was a scintilla of evidence, because I think that this is largely what this case is going to come down to, I would say that there are three specific places that I would point the court to. One, the description, I believe it comes in from Ms. Ortiz-Pedraza, with respect to hearing an exchanging of blows. Two, I would say that the court should look seriously at the injuries that occur to both parties, namely that Sergio ends up with a series of lacerations from knives on his hands that are consistent with the evidence with respect to what a defensive wound is in this case. Beyond that, I would say that, and I believe Judge Atlee specifically highlighted this portion during our back and forth earlier, which is that the testimony of Sergio is that there is that he picks up the knives in order to separate himself or in order to stab his brother. I cited it before, and I remember that it's Joint Appendix 1471. I can't remember the specific language, but it goes to the issue of protecting himself. Beyond that, what would need to be established is whether or not this is an accidental action or whether it is an intentional act. And certainly the argument that was made to the jury was that this was an accidental act. It's true, it's absolute, and what was stated in the record is a fair reflection of what the closing argument was in this matter, as made by my co-counsel in the matter. With respect to whether or not this was a volitional act, the testimony of Ms. Schmidt, who comes down the stairs and sees the sort of crescendo of this long 5 to 7 minute struggle, is what sounds like, from the testimony, a volitional act of an overhand stabbing. The testimony of Mr. Zuniga Robles is that he then subsequently gathers up all the knives, gets rid of the one that he believes had been used against him by his brother for fear that his brother would get into trouble, and puts other knives in the sink. The knife that goes over the fence and is subsequently found by our investigator, Mr. Kopko, doesn't have, at the point that it's found, any DNA on it to establish one way or the other what was going on, but there was a mixture of the blood of the parties. I'm not going to remember on whether it was the skinny knife or the fat knife, but on one of the two knives, and that's not my phraseology, that's what it was referred to as by the trial court in the Commonwealth, one of those knives has the blood of both parties on it, and I think that that's significant as the court makes a determination. Beyond that, there's it is a chaotic scene within the home in terms of blood on the walls, blood on the baseboards, blood in a variety of places. There's not testing to establish whether or not Sergio or Mario's blood is whose is where. But certainly what is reflected in the overarching scene is one in which self-defense was employed. Certainly we believe that it's an accurate statement of law to say that a person is not required to retreat within their home, and we would certainly point the court to the rulings of both West Virginia and Florida as cited, and I believe it's State v. Hardin, and I'm not going to remember the Florida case. I believe it's an overturning of Bobbitt that's also referenced, and so I'd point the court in that direction, and I'll see the rest of my time, but we would ask the court to set aside the verdict and remand the matter to trial court.
Thank you. We will come down and greet counsel and our honored guests.